rather than slowly? Isn't it better to support high-energy activities, quickly contracting muscles, quickly working nerve fibers, intense and long-sustained thought, than to creep slowly and sense gradually and have only a blurred awareness of the immediate surroundings? Isn't it? Granted, said Trevise. It is. What of it? Well, don't you know you must pay for warm-bloodedness? To maintain your temperature above that of your surroundings, you must expend energy far more wastefully than a tortoise must. You must be eating almost constantly, so that you can pour energy into your body as quickly as it leaks out. You would starve far more quickly than a tortoise would, and die more quickly, too. Would you rather be a tortoise and live more slowly and longer? Or would you rather pay the price and be a quick-moving, quick-sensing, thinking organism? Is this a true analogy, Bliss? No, Trevise, for the situation with Gaia is more favorable. We don't expend unusual quantities of energy when we are compactly together. It is only when part of Gaia is at hyperspatial distances from the rest of Gaia that energy expenditure rises. And remember that what you have voted for is not merely a larger Gaia, not a larger individual world. You have decided for Galaxia, for a vast complex of worlds. Anywhere in the galaxy, you will be part of Galaxia, and you will be closely surrounded by parts of something that extends from each interstellar atom to the central black hole. It would then require small amounts of energy to remain a whole. No part would be at any great distance from all other parts. It is all this you have decided for, Trevise. How can you doubt that you have chosen well? Trevise's head was bent in thought. Finally, he looked up and said, I may have chosen well, but I must be convinced of that. The decision I have made is the most important in the history of humanity, and it is not enough that it be a good one. I must know it to be a good one. What more do you need than what I have told you? I don't know, but I will find it on Earth. He spoke with absolute conviction. Pellerat said, Golan, the star shows a disk. It did. The computer, busy about its own affairs and not the least concerned with any discussion that might swirl about it, had been approaching the star in stages and had reached the distance Trevise had set for it. They continued to be well outside the planetary plane, and the computer split the screen to show each of three small inner planets. It was the innermost that had a surface temperature in the liquid water range, and that had an oxygen atmosphere as well. Trevise waited for its orbit to be computed, and the first crude estimate seemed reasonable. He kept that computation going, for the longer the planetary movement was observed, the more accurate the computation of its orbital elements. Trevise said quite calmly, We have a habitable planet in view, very likely habitable. Ah! Pellerat looked as nearly delighted as his solemn expression would allow. I'm afraid, though, said Trevise, that there's no giant satellite. In fact, no satellite of any kind has been detected so far, so it isn't Earth, at least not if we go by tradition. Don't worry about that, Golan, said Pellerat. I rather suspected we weren't going to encounter Earth here when I saw that neither of the gas giants had an unusual ring system. Very well, then, said Trevise. The next step is to find out the nature of the life inhabiting it. From the fact that it has an oxygen atmosphere, we can be absolutely certain that there is plant life upon it. But... Animal life, too, said Bliss abruptly, and in quantity. What? Trevise turned to her. I can sense it, only faintly at this distance, but the planet is unquestionably not only habitable, but inhabited. The far star was in polar orbit about the forbidden world, at a distance great enough to keep the orbital period at a little in excess of 6 days. Treves seemed in no hurry to come out of orbit. Since the planet is inhabited, he explained, and since, according to Deniador, it was once inhabited by human beings who were technologically advanced and who represent a first wave of settlers, the so-called spacers, they may be technologically advanced still and may have no great love for us of the second wave who have replaced them. I would like them to show themselves so that we can learn a little about them before risking a landing. They may not know we are here, said Pellerat. We would, if the situation were reversed. I must assume, then, that if they exist, they are likely to try to make contact with us. They might even want to come out and get us. But if they did come out after us and were technologically advanced, we might be helpless to... I can't believe that, said Treves. Technological advancement is not necessarily all one piece. They might conceivably be far beyond us in some ways, but it's clear they don't indulge in interstellar travel. It is we, not they, who have settled the galaxy. And in all the history of the Empire, I know of nothing that would indicate that they left their worlds and made themselves evident to us. If they haven't been space traveling, how could they be expected to have made serious advances in astronautics? And if they haven't, they can't possibly have anything like a gravitic chip. We may be essentially unarmed, but even if they come lumbering after us with a battleship, they couldn't possibly catch us. No, we wouldn't be helpless. Their advance may be in mentalics. It may be that the mule was a spacer. Treves shrugged in clear irritation. The mule can't be everything. The Gaians have described him as an aberrant Gaian. He's also been considered a random mutant. Pellerat said, To be sure, there have also been speculations, not taken very seriously, of course, that he was a mechanical artifact. A robot, in other words, though that word wasn't used. If there is something that seems mentally dangerous, we will have to depend on Bliss to neutralize that. She can... Is she asleep now, by the way? She has been, said Pellerat. But she was stirring when I came out here. Stirring, was she? Well, she'll have to be awake on short notice if anything starts happening. You'll have to see to that, Janoff. Yes, Golan, said Pellerat quietly. Treves shifted his attention to the computer. One thing that bothers me are the entry stations. Ordinarily, they are a sure sign of a planet inhabited by human beings with a high technology. But these... Is there something wrong with them? Several things. In the first place, they're very archaic. They might be thousands of years old. In the second, there's no radiation but thermals. What are thermals? Thermal radiation is given off by any object warmer than its surroundings. It's a familiar signature that everything yields, and it consists of a broad band of radiation following a fixed pattern, depending on temperature. That is what the entry stations are radiating. If there are working human devices aboard the stations, there is bound to be a leakage of non-thermal, non-random radiation. Since only thermals are present, we can assume that either the stations are empty, and have been perhaps for thousands of years, or if occupied, it is by people with a technology so advanced in this direction that they leak no radiation. Perhaps, said Pellerat, the planet has a high civilization, but the entry stations are empty because the planet has been left so strictly alone for so long by our kind of settlers that they are no longer concerned about any approach. Perhaps. Or perhaps it is a lure of some sort. Bliss entered, and Trevise, noting her out of the corner of his eye, said grumpily, Yes, here we are. So I see, said Bliss, and still in an unchanged orbit. I can tell that much. Pellerat explained hastily, Golan is being cautious, dear. The entry stations seem unoccupied, and we're not sure of the significance of that. There's no need to worry about it, said Bliss indifferently. There are no detectable signs of intelligent life on the planet we're orbiting. Trevise bent an astonished glare at her. What are you talking about? You said... I said there was animal life on the planet, and so there is. But where in the galaxy were you taught that animal life necessarily implies human life? Why didn't you say this when you first detected animal life? Because at that distance I couldn't tell. I could barely detect the unmistakable wash of animal neural activity, but there was no way I could, at that intensity, tell butterflies from human beings. And now? We're much closer now, and you may have thought I was asleep, but I wasn't, or at least only briefly. I was, to use an inappropriate word, listening as hard as I could for any sign of mental activity complex enough to signify the presence of intelligence. And there isn't any. I would suppose, said Bliss with sudden caution, that if I detect nothing at this distance, there can't possibly be more than a few thousand human beings on the planet. If we come closer, I can judge it still more delicately. Well, that changes things, said Trevise with some confusion. I suppose, said Bliss, who looked distinctly sleepy and therefore irritable. You can now discard all this business of analyzing radiation and inferring and deducing and who knows what else you may have been doing. My Gaian senses do the job much more efficiently and surely. Perhaps you see what I mean when I say it is better to be a Gaian than an isolate. Trevise waited before answering, clearly laboring to hold his temper. When he spoke, it was with a polite and almost formal tone. I am grateful to you for the information. Nevertheless, you must understand that, to use an analogy, the thought of the advantage of improving my sense of smell would be insufficient motive for me to decide to abandon my humanity and become a bloodhound. 34. They could see the forbidden world now as they moved below the cloud layer and drifted through the atmosphere. It looked curiously moth-eaten. The polar regions were icy, as might be expected, but they were not large in extent. The mountainous regions were barren, with occasional glaciers, but they were not large in extent either. There were some small desert areas, well scattered. Putting all that aside, the planet was, in potential, beautiful. Its continental areas were quite large, but sinuous, so that there were long shorelines and rich coastal plains of generous extent. There were lush tracts of both tropical and temperate forests, rimmed by grasslands. And yet the moth-eaten nature of it all was evident. Scattered through the forests were semi-barren areas, and parts of the grasslands were thin and sparse. Some sort of plant disease? Said Pellerat wonderingly. No, said Bliss slowly. Something worse than that, and more permanent. I've seen a number of worlds, said Trevise, but nothing like this. I have seen very few worlds, said Bliss, but I think the thoughts of Gaia, and this is what you might expect of a world from which humanity has disappeared. Why? Said Trevise. Think about it, said Bliss tartly. No inhabited world has a true ecological balance. Earth must have had one originally, for if that was the world on which humanity evolved, there must have been long ages when humanity did not exist, or any species capable of developing an advanced technology and the ability to modify the environment. In that case, a natural balance, ever-changing, of course, must have existed. On all other inhabited worlds, however, human beings have carefully terraformed their new environments and established plant and animal life. But the ecological system they introduce is bound to be unbalanced. It would possess only a limited number of species, and only those that human beings wanted or couldn't help introducing. Pellerat said, "You know what that reminds me of? Pardon me, Bliss, for interrupting, but it so fits that I can't resist telling you right now before I forget. There's an old creation myth I once came across, a myth in which life was formed on a planet and consisted of only a limited assortment of species, just those useful to or pleasant for humanity. The first human beings then did something silly. Never mind what, old fellow, because those old myths are usually symbolic and only confusing if they are taken literally. And the planet's soil was cursed. Thorns also, and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, is the way the curse was quoted, though the passage sounds much better in the archaic galactic in which it was written. The point is, though, was it really a curse? Things human beings don't like and don't want, such as thorns and thistles, may be needed to balance the ecology." Bliss smiled. "It's really amazing, pal, how everything reminds you of a legend, and how illuminating they are sometimes. Human beings, in terraforming a world, leave out the thorns and thistles, whatever they may be, and human beings then have to labor to keep the world going. It isn't a self-supporting organism, as Gaia is. It is rather a miscellaneous collection of isolates, and the collection isn't miscellaneous enough to allow the ecological balance to persist indefinitely. If humanity disappears, and if its guiding hands are removed, the world's pattern of life inevitably begins to fall apart. The planet unterraforms itself." Trevise said skeptically, "If that's what's happening, it doesn't happen quickly. This world may have been free of human beings for 20,000 years, and yet most of it still seems to be very much a going concern." "Surely," said Bliss, "that depends on how well the ecological balance was set up in the first place. If it is a fairly good balance to begin with, it might last for a long time without human beings. After all, 20,000 years, though very long in terms of human affairs, is just overnight when compared to a planetary lifetime."
"I suppose," said Pellerat, staring intently at the planetary vista, "that if the planet is degenerating, we can be sure that the human beings are gone."
Bliss said, "I still detect no mental activity at the human level, and I am willing to suppose that the planet is safely free of humanity. There is the steady hum and buzz of lower levels of consciousness, however, levels high enough to represent birds and mammals. Just the same, I'm not sure that unterraforming is enough to show human beings are gone. A planet might deteriorate, even if human beings existed upon it, if the society were itself abnormal and did not understand the importance of preserving the environment."
"Surely," said Pellerat, "such a society would quickly be destroyed. I don't think it would be possible for human beings to fail to understand the importance of retaining the very factors that are keeping them alive."
Bliss said, "I don't have your pleasant faith in human reason, pal. It seems to me to be quite conceivable that when a planetary society consists only of isolates, local and even individual concerns might easily be allowed to overcome planetary concerns."
I don't think that's conceivable, said Trevise, any more than Pellerat does. In fact, since human-occupied worlds exist by the million, and none of them have deteriorated in an unterraforming fashion, your fear of isolatism may be exaggerated, Bliss. The ship now moved out of the daylight hemisphere into the night. The effect was that of a rapidly deepening twilight, and then utter darkness outside, except for starlight, where the sky was clear. The ship maintained its height by accurately monitoring the atmospheric pressure and gravitational intensity. They were at a height too great to encounter any upthrusting mountainous massif, for the planet was at a stage when mountain building had not recently taken place. Still, the computer felt its way forward with its microwave fingertips, just in case. Trevise regarded the velvety darkness and said thoughtfully, "Somehow, what I find most convincing as the sign of a deserted planet is the absence of visible light on the dark side. No technological society could possibly endure darkness. As soon as we get into the day side, we'll go lower."
"What would be the use of that?" said Pellerat. "There's nothing there."
"Who said there's nothing there?"
"Bliss did, and you did."
"No, Janoff. I said there's no radiation of technological origin, and Bliss said there's no sign of human mental activity. But that doesn't mean there's nothing there. Even if there are no human beings on the planet, there would surely be relics of some sort. I'm after information, Janoff, and the remainders of the technology may have its uses in that direction."
"After 20,000 years?"
Pellerat's voice climbed in pitch.
"What do you think can survive 20,000 years? There will be no films, no paper, no print. Metal will have rusted, wood will have decayed, plastic will be in shattered grains. Even stone will have crumbled and eroded."
"It may not be 20,000 years," said Trevise patiently. "I mentioned that time as the longest period the planet may have been left empty of human beings, because Comparellian legend has this world flourishing at that time. But suppose the last human beings had died, or vanished, or fled, only 1,000 years ago." They arrived at the other end of the night side, and the dawn came and brightened into sunlight almost instantaneously. The far star sank downward and slowed its progress until the details of the land surface were clearly visible. The small islands that dotted the continental shores could now be clearly seen. Most were green with vegetation. Trevise said, "It's my idea that we ought to study the spoiled areas particularly. It seems to me that those places where human beings were most concentrated would be where the ecological balance was most lacking. Those areas might be the nucleus of the spreading blight of unterraforming. What do you think, Bliss?"
"It's possible. In any case, in the absence of definite knowledge, we might as well look where it's easiest to see. The grasslands and forests would have swallowed most signs of human habitation, so that looking there might prove a waste of time."
"It strikes me," said Pellerat, "that a world might eventually establish a balance with what it has, that new species might develop, and that the bad areas might be recolonized on a new basis."
"Possibly, Pell," said Bliss. "It depends on how badly out of balance the world was in the first place. And for a world to heal itself and achieve a new balance through evolution would take far more than 20,000 years. We'd be talking millions of years."
The far star was no longer circling the world. It was drifting slowly across a 500-kilometer-wide stretch of scattered heath and firs, with occasional clumps of trees.
"What do you think of that?" said Trevise suddenly, pointing.
The ship came to a drifting halt and hovered in midair. There was a low but persistent hum, as the gravitic engines shifted into high, neutralizing the planetary gravitational field almost entirely. There was nothing much to see where Trevise pointed. Tumbled mounds bearing soil and sparse grass were all that was visible.
"It doesn't look like anything to me," said Pellerette.
"There's a straight-line arrangement to that junk. Parallel lines. And you can make out some faint lines at right angles, too. See? See? You can't get that in any natural formation. That's human architecture, marking out foundations and walls, just as clearly as though they were still standing there to be looked at."
"Suppose it is," said Pellerette. "That's just a ruin. If we're going to do archaeological research, we're going to have to dig and dig. Professionals would take years to do it properly."
"Yes, but we can't take the time to do it properly. That may be the faint outline of an ancient city, and something of it may still be standing. Let's follow those lines and see where they take us." It was toward one end of the area, at a place where the trees were somewhat more thickly clumped, that they came to standing walls, or partially standing ones. Trevise said,
"Good enough for a beginning. We're landing."
Chapter 9. Facing the Pack. 35. The Far Star came to rest at the bottom of a small rise, a hill in the generally flat countryside. Almost without thought, Trevise had taken it for granted that it would be best for the ship not to be visible for miles in every direction. He said, "The temperature outside is 24 degrees centigrade. The wind is about 11 kilometers per hour from the west, and it is partly cloudy. The computer does not know enough about the general air circulation to be able to predict the weather. However, since the humidity is some 40%, it seems scarcely about to rain. On the whole, we seem to have chosen a comfortable latitude or season of the year, and after Camporeon, that's a pleasure."
"I suppose," said Pellerette, "that as the planet continues to unterraform, the weather will become more extreme."
"I'm sure of that," said Bliss.
"Be as sure as you like," said Trevise. "We have thousands of years of leeway. Right now, it's still a pleasant planet, and will continue to be so for our lifetimes and far beyond."
He was clasping a broad belt about his waist as he spoke, and Bliss said sharply,
"What's that, Trevise?"
"Just my old Navy training," said Trevise. "I'm not going into an unknown world unarmed."
"Are you seriously intending to carry weapons?"
"Absolutely. Here on my right," he slapped a holster that contained a massive weapon with a broad muzzle, "is my blaster. And here on my left," a smaller weapon with a thin muzzle that contained no opening, "is my neuronic whip."
"Two varieties of murder," said Bliss with distaste.
"Only one. The blaster kills. The neuronic whip doesn't. It just stimulates the pain nerves. And it hurts so that you can wish you were dead, I'm told. Fortunately, I've never been at the wrong end of one."
"Why are you taking them?"
"I told you, it's an enemy world."
"Trevise, it's an empty world."
"Is it? There's no technological society, it would seem. But what if there are post-technological primitives? They may not possess anything worse than clubs or rocks, but those can kill, too."
Bliss looked exasperated, but lowered her voice in an effort to be reasonable.
"I detect no human neuronic activity, Trevise. That eliminates primitives of any type, post-technological or otherwise."
"Then I won't have to use my weapons," said Trevise. "Still, what harm would there be in carrying them?
they'll just make me a little heavier. And since the gravitational pull at the surface is about 91% that of Terminus, I can afford the weight. Listen, the ship may be unarmed as a ship, but it has a reasonable supply of hand weapons. I suggest that you two also...
No,
said Bliss at once. I will not make even a gesture in the direction of killing, or of inflicting pain either. It's not a question of killing, but of avoiding being killed, if you see what I mean. I can protect myself in my own way. Janoff? Pellerat hesitated. We didn't have arms on Camporeon. Come, Janoff. Camporeon was a known quantity, a world associated with the Foundation. Besides, we were at once taken into custody. If we had had weapons, they would have been taken away. Do you want a blaster? Pellerat shook his head. I've never been in the Navy, old chap. I wouldn't know how to use one of those things. And in an emergency, I would never think of it in time. I'd just run and get killed.
You won't get killed, pal, said Bliss energetically. Gaia has you in its protection, and that posturing naval hero as well.
Trevilla said, Good. I have no objection to being protected, but I am not posturing. I am simply making assurance doubly sure. And if I never have to make a move toward these things, I'll be completely pleased, I promise you. Still, I must have them. He patted both weapons affectionately and said, Now let's step out on this world, which may not have felt the weight of human beings upon its surface for thousands of years. 36. I have a feeling, said Pellerat, that it must be rather late in the day, but the sun is high enough to make it near noon, perhaps. I suspect, said Trevise, looking about the quiet panorama, that your feeling originates out of the sun's orange tint, which gives it a sunset feel. If we're still here at actual sunset and the cloud formations are proper, we ought to experience a deeper red than we're used to. I don't know whether you'll find it beautiful or depressing. For that matter, it was probably even more extreme on Camporeon, but there we were indoors virtually all the time. He turned slowly, considering the surroundings in all directions. In addition to the almost subliminal oddness of the light, there was the distinctive smell of the world, or this section of it. It seemed a little musty, but far from actively unpleasant. The trees nearby were of middling height and looked old, with gnarled bark and trunks a little off the vertical, though because of a prevailing wind or something off-color about the soil, he couldn't tell. Was it the trees that lent a somehow menacing ambiance to the world, or was it something else, less material? Bliss said, What do you intend to do, Trevise? Surely we didn't come all this distance to enjoy the view. Trevise said, Actually, perhaps that ought to be my part of it just now. I would suggest that Janoff explore this place. There are ruins off in that direction, and he's the one who can judge the value of any records he might find. I imagine he can understand writings or films in archaic galactic, and I know quite well I wouldn't. And I suppose, Bliss, you want to go with him in order to protect him. As for me, I will stay here as a guard on the outer rim.
A guard against what? Primitives with rocks and clubs?
Perhaps. And then the smile that had hovered about his lips faded, and he said, Oddly enough, Bliss, I'm a little uneasy about this place. I can't say why. Pellerat said, Come, Bliss.
I've been a homebody collector of old tales all my life.
Pellerat said, Come, Bliss, I've been a homebody collector of old tales all my life, so I've never actually put my hands on ancient documents. Just imagine if we could find...
Trevise watched them walk away, Pellerat's voice fading as he walked eagerly toward the ruins, Bliss swinging along at his side.
Trevise listened absently and then turned back to continue his study of the surroundings. What could there be to rouse apprehension? He had never actually set foot upon a world without a human population, but he had viewed many from space. Usually they were small worlds, not large enough to hold either water or air, but they had been useful as marking a meeting site during naval maneuvers. There had been no war in his lifetime, or for a century before his birth, but maneuvers went on. Or as an exercise in simulated emergency repairs. Ships he had been on had been in orbit about such worlds, or had even rested on them, but he had never had occasion to step off the ships at those times. Was it that he was now actually standing on an empty world? Would he have felt the same if he had been standing on one of the many small, airless worlds he had encountered in his student days, and even since? He shook his head. It wouldn't have bothered him. He was sure of that. He would have been in a spacesuit, as he had been innumerable times when he was free of his ship in space. It was a familiar situation, and contact with a mere lump of rock would have produced no alteration in the familiarity. Surely. Of course, he was not wearing a spacesuit now. He was standing on a habitable world, as comfortable to the feel as Terminus would be, far more comfortable than Camporeon had been. He experienced the wind against his cheek, the warmth of the sun on his back, the rustle of vegetation in his ears. Everything was familiar, except that there were no human beings on it, at least not any longer. Was that it? Was it that made the world seem so eerie? Was it that it was not merely an uninhabited world, but a deserted one? He had never been on a deserted world before, never heard of a deserted world before, never thought a world could be deserted. All the worlds he had known of till now, once they had been populated by human beings, remained so populated forever. He looked up toward the sky. Nothing else had deserted it. An occasional bird flew across his line of vision, seeming more natural somehow than the slate-blue sky between the orange-tinted fair-weather clouds. Trevise was certain that, given a few days on the planet, he would become accustomed to the off-color, so that sky and clouds would grow to seem normal to him. He heard bird songs from the trees and the softer noise of insects. Bliss had mentioned butterflies earlier, and here they were, in surprising numbers and in several colorful varieties. There were also occasional rustlings in the clumps of grass that surrounded the trees, but he could not quite make out what was causing them. Nor did the obvious presence of life in his vicinity rouse fear in him. As Bliss had said, terraformed worlds had, from the very first, lacked dangerous animals. The fairy tales of childhood and the heroic fantasies of his teenage years were invariably set on a legendary world that must have been derived from the vague myths of Earth. The hyperdrama holoscreen had been filled with monsters, lions, unicorns, dragons, whales, brontosaurs, bears. There were dozens of them with names he could not remember, some of them surely mythical, and perhaps all of them. There were smaller animals that bit and stung, even plants that were fearful to the touch, but only in fiction. He had once heard that primitive honeybees were able to sting, but certainly no real bees were in any way harmful. Slowly, he walked to the right, skirting the border of the hill. The grass was tall and rank, but sparse, growing in clumps.
he made his way among the trees, also growing in clumps. Then he yawned. Certainly nothing exciting was happening, and he wondered if he might not retreat to the ship and take a nap. No, unthinkable. Clearly, he had to stand on guard. Perhaps he ought to do sentry duty, marching 1-2, 1-2, swinging about with a snap, and performing complicated maneuverings with a parade electrorod. It was a weapon no warrior had used in 3 centuries, but it was still absolutely essential at drill, for no reason anyone could ever advance. He grinned at the thought of it, then wondered if he ought to join Pellerat and Bliss in the ruins. Why? What good would he do? Suppose he saw something that Pellerat had happened to overlook. Well, time enough to make the attempt after Pellerat returned. If there was anything that might be found easily, by all means, let Pellerat make the discovery. Might the two be in trouble? Foolish. What possible kind of trouble? And if there were trouble, they would call out. He stopped to listen. He heard nothing. And then the irresistible thought of sentry duty recurred to him, and he found himself marching, feet moving up and down with a stamp, an imaginary electrorod coming off one shoulder, whirling and being held out straight before him, exactly vertical. Whirling again, end over end, and back over the other shoulder. Then, with a smart about face, he was looking toward the ship, rather far off now, once more. And when he did that, he froze in reality, and not in sentry make-believe. He was not alone. Until then, he had not seen any living creature other than plant growth, insects, and an occasional bird. He had neither seen nor heard anything approach. But now, an animal stood between him and the ship. Sheer surprise at the unexpected event deprived him for a moment of the ability to interpret what he saw. It was not till after a perceptible interval that he knew what he was looking at. It was only a dog. Trevise was not a dog person. He had never owned a dog, and he felt no surge of friendliness toward one when he encountered it. He felt no such surge this time either. He thought, rather impatiently, that there was no world on which these creatures had not accompanied men. They existed in countless varieties, and Trevise had long had the weary impression that each world had at least one variety characteristic of itself. Nevertheless, all varieties were constant in this, whether they were kept for entertainment, show, or some form of useful work. They were bred to love and trust human beings. It was a love and trust Trevise had never appreciated. He had once lived with a woman who had had a dog. That dog, whom Trevise tolerated for the sake of the woman, conceived a deep-seated adoration for him, followed him about, leaned against him when relaxing, all 50 pounds of him, covered him with saliva and hair at unexpected moments, and squatted outside the door and moaned whenever he and the woman were trying to engage in sex. From that experience, Trevise had emerged with the firm conviction that, for some reason known only to the canine mind and its odor-analyzing ability, he was a fixed object of doggish devotion. Therefore, once the initial surprise was over, he surveyed the dog without concern. It was a large dog, lean and rangy, with long legs. It was staring at him with no obvious sign of adoration. Its mouth was open in what might have been taken as a welcoming grin, but the teeth displayed were somehow large and dangerous, and Trevise decided that he would be more comfortable without the dog in his line of view. It occurred to him then that the dog had never seen a human being, and that countless canine generations preceding had never seen one. The dog might have been as astonished and uncertain at the sudden appearance of a human being as Trevise had been at that of the dog. Trevise, at least, had quickly recognized the dog for what it was, but the dog did not have that advantage. It was still puzzled, and perhaps alarmed.
Clearly, it would not be safe to leave an animal that large and with such teeth in an alarmed state.
Trevise realized that it would be necessary to establish a friendship at once. Very slowly, he approached the dog. No sudden motions, of course. He held out his hand, ready to allow it to be sniffed, and made soft, soothing sounds, most of which consisted of, "Nice doggy," something he found intensely embarrassing. The dog, eyes fixed on Trevise, backed away a step or two, as though in distrust, and then its upper lip wrinkled into a snarl, and from its mouth there issued a rasping growl. Although Trevise had never seen a dog behave so, there was no way of interpreting the action as representing anything but menace. Trevise therefore stopped advancing and froze. His eyes caught motion to one side, and his head turned slowly. There were two other dogs advancing from that direction. They looked just as deadly as the first. Deadly? That adjective occurred to him only now, and its dreadful appropriateness was unmistakable. His heart was suddenly pounding. The way to the ship was blocked. He could not run aimlessly, for those long canine legs would reach him in yards. If he stood his ground and used his blaster, then while he killed one, the other two would be upon him. Off in the distance, he could see other dogs approaching. Was there some way in which they communicated? Did they hunt in packs? Slowly, he shifted ground leftward, in a direction in which there were no dogs, as yet. Slowly, slowly. The dog shifted ground with him. He felt certain that all that saved him from instant attack was the fact that the dogs had never seen or smelled anything like himself before. They had no established behavior pattern they could follow in his case. If he ran, of course, that would represent something familiar to the dogs. They would know what to do if something the size of Trevise showed fear and ran. They would run, too. Faster. Trevise kept sidling toward a tree. He had the wildest desire to move upward where the dogs could not follow. They moved with him, snarling softly, coming closer. All three had their eyes fixed unwinkingly upon him. Two more were joining them, and farther off, Trevise could see still other dogs approaching. At some point, when he was close enough, he would have to make the dash. He could not wait too long or run too soon. Either might be fatal. Now. He probably set a personal record for acceleration, and even so it was a near thing. He felt the snap of jaws close on the heel of one foot, and for just a moment he was held fast before the teeth slid off the tough ceramoid. He was not skilled at climbing trees. He had not climbed one since he was 10, and as he recalled, that had been a clumsy effort. In this case, though, the trunk was not quite vertical, and the bark was gnarled and offered handholds. What was more, he was driven by necessity, and it is remarkable what one can do if the need is great enough. Trevise found himself sitting in a crotch, perhaps 10 meters above the ground. For the moment, he was totally unaware that he had scraped one hand and that it was oozing blood. At the base of the tree, 5 dogs now sat on their haunches, staring upward, tongues lolling, all looking patiently expectant. What now?
37. Trevise was not in a position to think about the situation in logical detail. Rather, he experienced flashes of thought in odd and distorted sequence, which, if he had eventually sorted them out, would have come to this. Bliss had earlier maintained that in terraforming a planet, human beings would establish an unbalanced economy, which they would be able to keep from falling apart only by unending effort. For instance, no settlers had ever brought with them any of the large predators. Small ones could not be helped. Insects, parasites, even small hawks, shrews, and so on. Those dramatic animals of legend and vague literary accounts, tigers, grizzly bears, orcs, crocodiles, who would carry them from world to world, even if there were sense to it? And where would there be sense to it? It meant that human beings were the only large predators, and it was up to them to cull those plants and animals that, left to themselves, would smother in their own overplenty. And if human beings somehow vanished, then other predators must take their place. But what predators? The most sizable predators tolerated by human beings were dogs and cats, tamed and living on human bounty. What if no human beings remained to feed them? They must then find their own food, for their survival, and, in all truth, for the survival of those they preyed on, whose numbers had to be kept in check, lest overpopulation do 100 times the damage that predations would do. So dogs would multiply in their variations, with the large ones attacking the large, untended herbivores, the smaller ones preying on birds and rodents. Cats would prey by night, as dogs did by day, the former singly and the latter in packs. And perhaps evolution would eventually produce more varieties to fill additional environmental niches. Would some dogs eventually develop sea-going characteristics to enable them to live on fish? And would some cats develop gliding abilities to hunt the clumsier birds in the air as well as on the ground? In flashes, all this came to Trevise while he struggled with more systematic thought to tell him what he might do. The number of dogs kept growing. He counted 23 now surrounding the tree, and there were others approaching. How large was the pack? What did it matter? It was large enough already. He withdrew his blaster from its holster, but the solid feel of the butt in his hand did not give him the sense of security he would have liked. When had he last inserted an energy unit into it, and how many charges could he fire? Surely not 23. What about Pellerat and Bliss? If they emerged, would the dogs turn on them? Were they safe even if they did not emerge? If the dogs sensed the presence of 2 human beings inside the ruins, what could stop them from attacking them there? Surely there would be no doors or barriers to hold them off. Could Bliss stop them and even drive them away? Could she concentrate her powers through hyperspace to the desired pitch of intensity? For how long could she maintain them? Should he call for help then? Would they come running if he yelled? And would the dogs flee under Bliss's glare? Would it take a glare, or was it simply a mental action undetectable to onlookers without the ability? Or, if they appeared, would they then be torn apart under the eyes of Trevise, who would be forced to watch helplessly from the relative safety of his post in the tree? No, he would have to use his blaster. If he could kill 1 dog and frighten them off for just a while, he could scramble down the tree, yell for Pellerat and Bliss, kill a 2nd dog if they showed signs of returning, and all 3 could then hustle to the ship. He adjusted the intensity of the microwave beam to the 3/4 mark. That should be ample to kill a dog with a loud report. The report would serve to frighten the dogs away, and he would be conserving energy. He aimed carefully at a dog in the middle of the pack, one who seemed, in Trevise's own imagination at least, to exude a greater malignancy than the rest. Perhaps only because he sat more quietly and therefore seemed more cold-bloodedly intent on his prey. The dog was staring directly at the weapon now, as though it scorned the worst Trevise could do.
It occurred to Trevise that he had never himself fired a blaster at a human being or seen anyone else do it. There had been firing at water-filled dummies of leather and plastic during training, with the water almost instantaneously heated to the boiling point and shredding the covering as it exploded. But who, in the absence of war, would fire at a human being? And what human being would withstand a blaster and force its use? Only here, on a world made pathological by the disappearance of human beings. With that odd ability of the brain to note something utterly beside the point, Trevise was aware of the fact that a cloud had hidden the sun, and then he fired. There was an odd shimmer of the atmosphere on a straight line from the muzzle of the blaster to the dog. A vague sparkle that might have gone unnoticed if the sun were still shining unhindered. The dog must have felt the initial surge of heat and made the smallest motion as though it were about to leap. And then it exploded, as a portion of its blood and cellular contents vaporized. The explosion made a disappointingly small noise, for the dog's integument was simply not as tough as that of the dummies they had practiced on. Flesh, skin, blood, and bone were scattered, however, and Trevise felt his stomach heave. The dog started back, some having been bombarded with uncomfortably warm fragments. That was only a momentary hesitation, however. They crowded against each other suddenly in order to eat what had been provided. Trevise felt his sickness increase. He was not frightening them. He was feeding them. At any rate, they would never leave. In fact, the smell of fresh blood and warm meat would attract still more dogs, and perhaps other small predators as well. A voice called out, "Trevise! What?" Trevise looked outward. Bliss and Pelerat had emerged from the ruins. Bliss had stopped short, her arms thrown out to keep Pelerat back. She stared at the dogs. The situation was obvious and clear. She had to ask nothing. Trevise shouted, "I tried to drive them off without involving you and Genoff. Can you hold them off?"
"Barely,"
said Bliss, not shouting, so that Trevise had trouble hearing her, even though the dog's snarling had quieted, as though a soothing, sound-absorbent blanket had been thrown over them. Bliss said,
"There are too many of them, and I am not familiar with their pattern of neuronic activity. We have no such savage things on Gaia."
"Or on Terminus, or on any civilized world," shouted Trevise. "I'll shoot as many of them as I can, and you try to handle the rest. A smaller number will give you less trouble."
"No, Trevise. Shooting them will just attract others. Stay behind me, pal. There's no way you can protect me. Trevise, your other weapon."
"The neuronic whip?"
"Yes. That produces pain. Low power. Low power."
"Are you afraid of hurting them?" called out Trevise in anger. "Is this a time to consider the sacredness of life?"
"I'm considering Pell's. Also mine. Do as I say. Low power and shoot at one of the dogs. I can't hold them much longer."
The dogs had drifted away from the tree and had surrounded Bliss and Pelerat, who stood with their backs to a crumbling wall. The dogs nearest the two made hesitant attempts to come closer still, whining a bit as though trying to puzzle out what it was that held them off when they could sense nothing that would do it. Some tried uselessly to scramble up the wall and attack from behind. Trevise's hand was trembling as he adjusted the neuronic whip to low power. The neuronic whip used much less energy than the blaster did, and a single power cartridge could produce hundreds of whip-like strokes. But come to think of it, he didn't remember when he had last charged this weapon either. It was not so important to aim the whip. Since conserving energy was not as critical, he could use it in a sweep across the mass of dogs.
That was the traditional method of controlling crowds that showed signs of turning dangerous. However, he followed Bliss's suggestion. He aimed at one